president talk for himself. He's just tweeted out, great again, plus 235,000.
It's a big number.
I think it was a perfect number. It was right exactly where it needed to be. Our jobs plan and our jobs creation and bringing jobs back to America is going exactly the way we'd like it to go.
340,000 people came back into the labor force in the last month. That helped with the participation rate rising 0.8%. So it may be that people now think it's a good time to go out and look for a job, and it appears to be.
And the Fed is essentially using what I'm calling the cover of darkness to really alter and change its policy to get a little more aggressive about raising rates.
The Fed is racing to get to 1.5% for the interest rate so that they can get above the next recession.
And we think we're more likely to get fewer rather than more hikes this year, but we won't rule out the more because the jobs data are just so strong. Where we are right now is almost unsustainable, and where we're going, there seems to be nothing in the pipes that's going to slow down the decline in the unemployment rate, and that means the Fed has to do something, and it has to be substantial.
So to tweet out, great way to start a Friday, I think, yes, the president was excited to see more Americans back to work. So I apologize if we were a little excited, and we're so glad to see so many fellow Americans back to work.
This is the Financial Sense News Hour. Now, here's the Financial Sense News team, Jim Poplava and John Loeffler.
Well, a very strong jobs number on Friday, beating expectations, 235,000 jobs created versus expectations of 197,000, all but guarantees that the Fed will probably raise interest rates next week. In fact, it's being already reflected in the bond market. Three-month Treasury bills are almost at 0.75%, and the two-year Treasury note is almost at 1.4. Hi, everyone. I'm Jim Poplava, and welcome to this week's edition of the Financial Sense News Hour. Coming up in Hour 1, Craig Johnson will be joining me from Piper Jaffray. If you remember, Craig was the guy that was predicting 2350 on the S&P last year. Well, we exceeded that number. He's got a new higher target. You're going to want to hear that. And he's got three themes coming forward: rates, rotation, and reflation, the three R's. That's coming up with Craig Johnson. Also, Frank Holmes will be joining me. We're talking about the divergence that we're starting to see between gold stocks and the performance of the commodity. That also applies to the energy markets. Well, there's a couple reasons behind it, and Frank will be here to talk about it. All of that coming up in Hour 1.
And I'm John Loeffler. You know, in the last 2 weeks, we've done a series on seven megatrends impacting the next decade. And surprise, surprise, three of those megatrends were in the news this week and also last weekend. So we'll quickly review those. But there are several megatrends which we think are so important, they merit shows all by themselves, separate from those seven. And today we're going to cover, on the big picture, the concept of infrastructure. This is something affecting all the major developed countries of the world, and it will affect not only government spending to try to rebuild and repair infrastructure, but also investment opportunities and implications. So we'll look at that particular megatrend for the better part of the big picture today. And then, of course, next week, the Fed will meet for the second time this year, and it is widely expected they will raise interest rates, making it the third rate hike, taking the funds Fed rate to taking the federal funds rate to 1%. But it seems like the president and Fed Chair Janet Yellen are at odds with each other. And right now, if they do raise interest rates, why is that? They can't argue that we have high inflation because we don't. They can't argue that the economy is overheating because it's not at about 1%. So exactly what are these guys doing at the Federal Reserve? It seems they're going to raise the rates until something breaks. That's their historic pattern. And we'll examine the feasibility of that as the second part of the big picture today, right here on the Financial Sense News Hour. However, as we always do every week, first we go to Ryan Poplava and refocus our discussion right now. Ryan Poplava, CEO of Poplava Financial Services, to talk about the financial markets this week and the drivers and catalysts behind investor sentiment near term. Well, you know, we had some interesting jobs reports this week, obviously. But Ryan, last week we talked about President Trump's speech and the debate between the hard versus soft economic data. Now, what are some of the primary concerns for investors this week?
Well, John, this week, I think most equity investors understand that stocks are technically overbought. And I think that's the main story. So we're a little bit of reversion back to the mean. But overall, haven't been any major stories to really change the story. Overall, though, we continue with solid economic results, earning results from the U.S. Just no real mystery of what's going on with monetary policy. It's pretty much everyone has a strong consensus of what's going on there. And then there's obviously the fiscal story, which does continue to develop. And especially this week, the GOP released their repeal and replace bill for the Affordable Care Act. And they're really trying to push it through. No real discussion behind it. And that's kind of drawing some attention. But there hasn't been any fainting on Wall Street, due to the bill. It's, like I said, it's not really changing the story, but it does seem that there's quite a bit of pushback and some backlash, which was eventually to happen. It's definitely a hot point for everyone, even the far right, who really want to see it completely abolished. So from what I've read, the bill will remove the requirement that all Americans get coverage or pay a penalty tax, as well as the requirement that businesses with over 50 employees provide insurance. So they are looking to get rid of those rules, replace some subsidies with tax credits, so a different way of helping and assisting. And then there's a charge they want to put on about a 30% surcharge if anybody allows their plan to lapse and then wants back in. At that point, when you want back in, there's going to be a big charge. So that's, I guess, their way of, instead of requiring everyone have it or pay a tax, well, if you no longer have it for a while, you're going to get a hit when you want to come back in. And it would also reduce Medicaid funding over time. So those were the big stories this week on fiscal policy.
It's going to be interesting because I want to see what they do for people who now, because of the intricacies of Obamacare rolled into our medical system, need to be grandfathered in. They're relying on this for whatever treatments they're getting and how this rolls out. I don't think they're forgetting that. I just want to see what they're proposing. And so far, things haven't come to the surface, Okay. Were there any other important market stories that we should be aware of this week?
I think there were two other ones besides, the GOP's release. It was mainly oil inventories. The American Petroleum Institute said that around 11.6 million barrels, there was a build in oil inventories. And I think I read somewhere else that this is the largest inventories have been since like the 90s. And that prompted a really sharp correction in oil. It was down like 5% on one day, I think. And we're now below 50. Currently, I think we closed on Friday at 48.44. So there was a follow-up Reuters article I read on Thursday, which talked about shale production growth. I think this isn't really a major story. We all know who's been following the rig count. We've been adding more rigs on a weekly basis. So they were just essentially saying that there are projections that U.S. companies will continue to ramp up. And the last I looked, I did take a look at the rig count this week, about 768 combined rigs, so gas and oil, 768. And that's well off the lows we saw last year, which were in the 300 range. So that's been a development. Oil is down 3 days in a row on that. So I think that's a developing story. We do look economically at oil to see how it's doing. If it's rising, that's a sign that the economy is growing. If it's falling, it's deflationary. And mind you, a lot of the inflationary numbers that we've seen over the past 6 months, a lot of that has been related to oil. And that's the story that the ECB had. And they did meet. That was the other story this week. The ECB meeting left rates unchanged and continued to maintain their accommodative language. But there was a small mention in there that some members are considering moving rates before maybe easing their bond purchase program. So bond purchase program, that's really affecting the long end of the yield curve. If they start to raise interest rates, that's on short-term deposits, and that it likely helps and assists in the short end of the yield curve. But that little mention did have an effect on the euro. And so we did see vice versa, the dollar weaken slightly this week on that news.
So the market closed down this week. But, first of all, it was interesting. I was listening to a CBS news broadcast this week where they said, well, the jobs report was really good. And that removes any excuse for, the Fed not raising interest rates a quarter of a point or maybe even a half a point, they were saying. So we did have a good jobs report. Are investors actually concerned that the Fed is going to do more than raise rates a quarter of a point next week?
The jobs reports, they were good, especially the private payrolls. That's the ADP report we get midweek. So that ahead of the public Bureau of Labor Statistics report on Friday took kind of the wind out of the sail of that report. So 298,000 non-government jobs were added, according to the ADP report, 235 adds when we put everything together with the Friday report. Those numbers, from what I'm seeing, the consensus, we actually had a really high probability of a rate hike this month before any of this job data. And that was as of last week. It was up near 80-90% chance, according to the Fed fund futures. This really solidified that we are going to get a rate hike. There was nothing there that really was surprising. What it does do is essentially shape the consensus around, okay, they're going to raise rates. What about the estimations for rates for the rest of the year? We get what we call the dot plot every quarter. And they were concerned that if the number was too hot in jobs, that it might shift this outlook of maybe 3 rate hikes this year to maybe 4. And so the consensus, I think, right now is based on that jobs number on Friday, is that it's still the same. We're looking at still 3 rate hikes this year. There were concerns, like I said, that it might be too hot, but no, looks like the consensus is a rate hike and no real more hawkish outlook for rates in 2017.
All right. Well, that concludes the wrap up for this week. It really sounds like the big event everybody is waiting for is next week's Fed meeting. And if we continue to hear more information about the GOP health bill, which repeals and then replaces the Affordable Care Act. You know, Ryan, I noticed you guys are doing a survey for the podcast because I got an email on Thursday. Some of our listeners just go to iTunes and may not have an RSS feed or receive alerts. Are you getting good feedback? And what areas are you targeting then? How can listeners help?
I'm glad you asked, John, because a lot of our listeners who just get the podcast from iTunes, you know, like you said, they're not going to get this little notice that we're doing this. But, you know, I hope our listeners tuning in right now might have the chance to take a look and maybe add their feedback, because it's really important to us. And, you know, the primary focus of this survey was to kind of evaluate the scope of content and the time of the podcast in general. We've adjusted that a few times over the last 5 years. And some of our younger listeners, you know, they may not have 1 to 2 hours per segment to dedicate every week. So we wanted to survey, find out what works best for you guys, and maybe offer possibly a scaled down version summarizing, you know, the main topics, big picture, in a 2 to 5 minute video on YouTube, which is, you know, that's what typically videos, their duration is on YouTube. So we've had some great results so far, though, this week. It's only been a couple of days of the reports we get back. There's a little box in there for you to specifically add some feedback and things that concern you guys and let you know I've read every single one. We'll be discussing your feedback and developing ideas to adjust our weekly show and our management meetings. And, you know, this is really a chance for us to hear from you, get that feedback, and you guys to be able to shape the content that you're getting and receiving. Maybe there's an area that we're not talking about that you really want to hear. You know, we've had recently some guests on infrastructure on Insider, and Jim, I think, is planning to have one on the weekend show. So our numbers, they've been going up, and we want to continue that trend. We want to make sure we're doing what our listeners want. Recently, we had about 51,000 tune in to Jim's Big Picture last weekend. So we're very humbled, John, by those numbers and by the feedback we're receiving. And I just want to say thank you, you know, to all of our listeners providing that feedback. If you want to help us, you know, make this the best financial podcast on the web, head over to our website, www.financialsense.com. Click on the green banner right at the top, and should take a minute or less. And you can also find it on our social website. So we'd love to hear from you. Our listeners are very loyal, and we really appreciate their feedback.
And we are incredibly humble. We are so humble, it is stunning. You know that, Ryan? So we wouldn't want to brag about it, though, anyway. All right, Ryan Poplava, thanks for another good report. Of course, obviously, we're looking toward what the Fed actually does next week and then the effect that that's going to have. I know Jim always talks about the Feds using an indicator in the economy, raising rates until something breaks, and then they go, oh, we went too far. That's about it. And that's not always healthy. So we'll see what happens. Anyway, Ryan Poplava, see you next week.
Sounds good. Talk to you then.
You're listening to the Financial Sense News Hour at financialsense.com. To speak to Jim Poplava or his financial planning team, call us toll-free at 888-486-3939. That's 888-486-3939. We'd be glad to help you plan your customized investment portfolio.
you're approaching retirement age or concerned about making plans for those retired years and having adequate income, you're going to want to hear our Lifetime Income series every Monday and Tuesday here at FinancialSense.com. Right now, here's a preview of this week's Lifetime Income program.
Joining me on the program is best-selling author Gary Tobbs. His new book, The Case Against Sugar. Gary, Americans have become inured to the epidemic of obesity. Last several decades, we've gone from 1 out of 8 Americans being obese to 1 out of 3. What do you believe is behind this epidemic?
Well, let's talk about what the conventional wisdom is. So the conventional thinking on this disorder, obesity, is that we get fat just because we consume more calories than we expend. So the reason, the explanation for the epidemic in general is that, you know, we eat too much and we're sedentary. And as populations like ours get more and more affluent, good tasting food is more available than ever. And you have less and less reason to have to actually do manual labor for a living. So even if we go to the gym or whatever we do, we're generally sedentary. And this caloric imbalance is what makes us fat. And the argument I've been making in all my books is that this is a very naive way to think about a very, you know, a complex physiological defect akin to a growth defect, and that you can find populations in history that had no affluence. I mean, you could find them still today, incredibly poor populations in which children are not getting enough calories to survive, they're malnourished, they're stunted, and you've got obese adults in these same populations. And it all argues for a hormonal kind of regulatory explanation for obesity that's triggered by something in our diet. And the prime suspect always has been and still is sugar. So the idea is, you know, sugar creates a hormonal milieu in the human body that, among its other negative effects, is to channel calories into our fat tissue and keep it there.
Well, here we are. The market's still heading higher as the Trump rally continues. Since it began on November 8th, the Dow Jones Industrial Average has traveled a little over 3,000 points. Will it be going higher, and what will be happening to the S&P? Does this thing stop? Does it pause? Joining us on the program is Craig Johnson from Piper Jaffray. Craig, you've long had a number of 2350 on the S&P by year end. Well, we've surpassed that number. So, my friend, where do we go from here?
Yeah, Jim, thanks for having me back. You know, we were looking for 2350 for year end 2016. For 2017, we laid out in about the November-December time frame a number of 2424 for 2017. So we missed our 2350 number by about 31 days. So we'll try to polish up the crystal ball for next year. But at this point in time, you know, Jim, there's a lot of fear in the market. A lot of investors are concerned that this market has moved too far too fast. A lot of discussion in the market about this being a bull market that's lasted for 8 years, and they're very skeptical as to whether this market advance can continue. And so as we think about this tape, I see a lot of very good things happening. Yes, over the short term, we've gotten overbought. But when you look back at some of the historical individuals who have done technical analysis for years, one of the things that Alan Shaw has said over the years is markets can get overbought and stay overbought for extended periods of time. And my sense is that perhaps we're in one of those periods right now, given that we haven't had a 1% correction on a daily basis going back for over 100 days at this point in time.
So given this upsurge that we've seen where we've hit your targets a little bit late, as you point out, but if we hit 2424, you know, you're still talking about a nice single digit year. And if you add dividends in on the S&P 500, you know, you may have a double digit year.
Right. I think 2017 and the way that I put together, the way that our thinking was going for 2017 is this is going to be a good year. Probably not a great year, not a year where you're up 20, 30%, something like that. But let's say you're up a high single digit, low double digit type year. And the three themes that we continue to think are going to be prevalent throughout the year are the three R's. It's going to be rates, rotation, and reflation. Those are the three R's that we're thinking about for this 2017. Now, do we see upside to the market? The answer is, yeah, I see upside to this market. And a couple of the things that I see in the charts right now is we still have a advanced decline line on the New York that's near its all-time highs. We've got the popular averages all hitting all-time new highs. And that's been a classic indicator of a secular bull market when you see not only the Dow, but the S&P, but the NASDAQ, all hitting, and the Russell, all hitting all-time new highs. And that has all happened. And what's interesting about this, Jim, is when you go back and you start looking at some of these historical gauges to give you a sense of, is this the beginning or is this the end of this particular bull market? A lot of people feel like it's the end. But if you step back and look at a couple of these things, there's only been about 21, 22 times going back into the 1950s where you've had greater than 70 sessions in a row and no 1% drop. Once you finally get that 1% drop, guess what? It's bought pretty quickly. And you look at the 13, 26, and 52-week returns after that, you're in the mid-teens with about an 85% probability of being right. So while we might get some sort of 1% correction or pullback at some point in time, it's going to get bought very quickly. The other interesting thing is that when you go back and you look at those trifecta of the new highs on all these different indices, again, when you go back and look at the probabilities when that has occurred in the past, what again we find is not a market that sells off, but a market that continues on higher on a 13, 26, and 52-week basis with a very good, solid probability. Same thing when you go back and look at those years where you have a January and a February both advancing, it sets up very nicely for the full return for the year. So again, as I go back and I keep looking at all these things, Jim, and I keep hearing the sentiment out there that things are extreme, it's short term, it's overbought. But when you step back and just look at the numbers and look at what history has suggested, it suggests that while you might have some short term weakness, the intermediate and longer term trend of this market is still higher, Jim.
Craig, what has kept you in this bullish camp? You've been one of the most bullish strategists that we've had on this program. And even at times, for example, in 2015 and parts of last year, because everybody remembers the way we started out the year where we went down for 6 weeks in a row, you remain bullish. What has caused you to maintain that bullish stance?
So what has kept us on the right side of this tape has been a couple things. One, when we've gone back and we've used this great set of tools that we put together here on the markets here at Piper Jaffray, we have this great database looking at all the prices, and we've got all these longer-term charts and trend analysis. Using those sets of tools is really what's kept me on the right side of this tape. And again, it hasn't been any sort of crazy, you know, algorithms or anything like that. It's simple trend analysis and looking at the points in time when this market hits the extremes. Extremes of 26-week new highs and lows, extremes of the groups above and below their 40-week moving averages. Those kind of indicators, even though they seem very simplistic, sometimes simple is better, and that's really what's helped keep us onto this tape and not get shaken out of it. Also, using those tools in combination with kind of thinking about history and the things that we're seeing in the marketplace and the sectors and the rotation and assembling these pieces is really kind of the ingredients that have helped us stay on the long-term trend of this market, Jim.
So let's take your themes for the remainder of the year. You have three of them: rates, rotation, reflation. Let's begin with rates, because one of the surprising aspects of the Trump election, not only did stocks take off, as they still continue to do, but we also saw a rise in interest rates, Craig. We had interest rates at close to 1.7% after reaching a low of a little over 1.3% during the summer. Now we have rates at over 2.5% on the 10-year note. So we saw rates rise as well. Do you see rates heading higher from where they are now? Because we've been in sort of this trading range since December, where we've been trading up and down within a quarter of a point, 2.5 to 2.3. Do you see rates going higher than that?
Yeah, so Jim, not only have rates gone up, but I think more importantly, the yield curve between the 2 and 10 is actually steepened. And I think that's probably as important as to the actual 10-year bond yield. But our in-print call for 10-year bond yields at year-end 2017, we're still looking for 3 to 3.25. So the short answer to your question, do we see rates going up? The answer is yes. And this morning was the first time I actually heard on a major media outlet somebody else besides myself talking about 3% or greater 10-year bond yield this year. And I think that's really interesting because the perception and sentiment is starting to suggest that this reflation trade and interest rates are finally starting to go up. So, yeah, we're bearish on bonds, bullish on equities, and I would just point out that the most significant thing with rates going to 3% this year is that rates reverse a 30-year downtrend. 1981 is when rates peaked, and when you draw that resistance line off of the highs all the way to where we are now at a 275 range, you start to reverse the long-term downtrend on rates. And I think at that point in time is when you finally get the biggest thing that a lot of bulls on Wall Street have been looking for, which is a rotation out of fixed income and into equities. And that's where I think the bull market will get another leg to go ultimately higher. A lot of that kick will probably come more in 2018 though than 2017 is my view.
Craig, let's talk about this higher rates. As you see, a steepening yield curve is good for banks because banks pay depositors less on their deposits and they can charge more on loans, which is an incentive. In other words, the profit margins for banks expand. Do you see these higher rates or the steepening yield curve transferring over to the financials?
Absolutely. As that curve remains steep and there is more lending activity that gets done, and we see that there is some fiscal policy reform happening in Washington, I think there will be all sort of incentive for businesses and small businesses specifically to borrow money to expand operations or to improve some of their infrastructure. So this is good for the banks. And, you know, Jim, take it one step further. We're seeing, I think, right now, a little bit of the opposite of what happened in 2007. In 2007, the markets were going higher, the financial sector disengaged, and was very divergent. And right now, we're seeing the financial sector in leading, if not in line with the market. Markets are going up. Everybody's nervous about this market going up. In 2007, nobody was nervous about the market. And you're seeing the exact opposite happening today. I find it kind of ironic as I look at the market and talk to investors every single day. They just are very nervous, waiting for some sort of pullback. And it's like, I think you're just sitting, waiting, and wishing.
So let's go to your second R. We have rates where you see the 10-year yield going to 3 or maybe 3.25%. That steepens the yield curve. That would be good for financials. So, in fact, let me go to another one of your R's first. Let's talk about reflation. We know that the economy is cruising along at 2%. The president is talking about stimulating the economy through tax cuts and infrastructure spending. I'm a little bit more pessimistic on the infrastructure spending because I just don't think they have the shovel-ready projects, and it may take some time to do so, although we're going to discuss that on the program today. But let's talk about your theme of reflation. What does that mean? If inflation is going up, that would support your thesis on higher interest rates, because if the Fed sees higher inflation rates, they're going to want to raise rates more. So let's talk about reflation and what that would mean for the stock market, especially the particular sectors that would do well.
Yeah, so if we're going to get a reflation trade to come on, I think what we're going to see happening is, if you come back to all these changes that are happening in Washington, there is no question the prior administration was trying to have this recovery drive more from monetary policy than from fiscal policy. And clearly that did not drive a pickup in a meaningful way for overall gross domestic product or GDP growth. Now we have a new administration in that is going to take some activities such as cut taxes. They are also going to perhaps change some of the accounting rules of depreciation so that if you do want to put in a new project, instead of a 3-year depreciation or something along those lines, it might be a 1-year or a 2-year, which would be a nice incentive for people to spend and corporations to spend and refresh a lot of the infrastructure that needs to get done. So under this kind of reflation trade scenario, I would think that basic materials, I think, could do very well. And I would also think the tech sector could probably do very well under that kind of setup. Clearly, we have seen post the Trump election, we have seen the basic material sector do well. It's come under a little bit of profit taking, I think, as of late. But to me, the right things are happening inside of the sector. Chemicals look like they're doing well. Steel stocks look like they're doing well. And gold continues to look weak, in my opinion, as I look at the charts or at the individual sectors or the commodity itself.
So what about if we're going through a reflation trade? You're talking about materials, tech would do well. What about energy in this kind of situation? Because one of the things that I've seen a divergence, Craig, and I'd like to get your comments on it. We've seen the price of oil until recently. The price of oil was in the, you know, low 50s, mid 50s. It's pulling back on the day you and I are talking to below 50. But the energy stocks have been heading down since the beginning of the year. What does that tell you about energy? And do you still believe energy would do well under these circumstances?
Yeah, so as I had been observing on the crude oil commodity itself, it looked like we were making, and I still think it is the case, pretty good bottoming pattern, what in the technical world we'd call an inverted head and shoulders pattern, with the neckline being at $50, and that is clearly being tested and pretty thoroughly here today with oil down 2% as we're taping the show, and also 5% the day before. So we're down 7% in 2 days. And I think what the concern is that right now supplies of crude oil have gotten too high, and we continue to see the build. It's been a very mild winter all over the country, and when you get no snow in Minnesota, that's a problem for a lot of people, whether they like the outdoor sports or anything else. But so one of the mildest winters that I have experienced in a long time. That being said, I would think that the energy sector would participate. I've been seeing some of the relative strength trends participate. And keep in mind, this is like just about the August-September timeframe is when we actually upgraded the oil sector. We had been neutral or underweight energy since 2011. So you can remember from some of the prior times I've been on your terrific show, Jim, that we've been very cautious on it. And we saw that there was a, looked like some sort of bottom getting made. So the bigger question that we all have to ask ourselves is the move up that we had seen over the last several months, was that more than just a relief rally? And that's something that will be played out, I think, in coming weeks and months as we go forward from here. I would think energy would participate, but right now there are certainly some question marks how solid this particular advance is going to be in the energy patch.
So on the reflation trade, if there was one sector that you may have some doubts about, it would be energy?
Certainly that is the case right now. I mean, the way the oil price has been reacting over the last couple of weeks in here, the way that some of the stocks have been reacting, you know, it's not very often that I see a divergence, like Jim, you had mentioned, between the energy stocks and the crude oil price. That is something that typically hasn't played out as much. But what I do find interesting and what everybody should pay attention to is oil sector is under a lot of pressure. Crude oil is down 7% in the last couple of days. And you look at the Dow, you look at the S&P, you look at the Russell, and you look at the NASDAQ today, and they're all up. So this is very different. Rewind a year ago, and what would we be seeing at this point in time, Jim, if the oil price was off this much? We'd be seeing the market selling off in a very big way. So something is changing for the positive here, even though oil prices have been weak as of late.
Let's turn to another commodity. With rising interest rates, let's talk about the dollar and gold.
So as we look at the dollar has been in a trading range. Dollar index had been trading between about 90 and 100 earlier this year, and post the Trump election win, the dollar started breaking out. And since then, we've been seeing the dollar starting to kind of come back and retest kind of the upper end of that trading range. I think there is now some concern that perhaps some of the policies that he's trying to get implemented are not happening quite as quickly, or perhaps we've been starting to see a pickup in countries in Europe and other places kind of offsetting some of the dollar strength we've seen. Earlier on, that had led some people or some investors to be nervous about the market, meaning that there was going to be a repeat of 2014 and 2015 where the dollar rose too quickly and we ultimately saw the market stumble as we saw a bit of a earnings headwind start to unfold with some of the big multinational companies. I don't think that's going to play out this way this time around. As I look at the earnings estimates for 2017, what I'm actually seeing is really pretty stable earnings trends as we've gotten through the first quarter earnings season, whereas in 2016 and 15, it looked like a crowbar and it had dropped off very quickly as you got through first quarter earnings. So as I think about the dollar, I think it's going to be underpinned with strength, but I don't see it moving out to a measured objective of 108 or anything like that anytime soon. I think it's going to take time to get to those kind of levels, which I think is a good thing for equities and a good thing for the large multinationals. Now, gold. I've said before, And I continue to believe that gold, the ultimate peak was made back in 2011. And every single move we've been seeing on a weekly or quarterly basis in gold has been these interesting relief rallies, but then they kind of fail at the downtrend resistance line off of those 2011 highs. And Jim, I just keep thinking about similar things happened in 1981 when you saw the peak of gold come. You saw the peak of bond yields, and you also saw the start of one of the best equity bull markets in history. Again, it seems to be rhyming with what we've seen in the past, and I don't think interest rates, even though they're going up, are going to be strong enough to suggest there's any inflationary fears and really underpin any sort of strength in gold at this point.
All right, let's throw some things that could be negative on the market. I wonder if you might comment on the Edson Gould adage, three steps and a stumble. So if the Fed goes next week, as widely as expected, they'll raise the Fed funds rate a quarter of a point. We'll get it to 1%, which is interesting, Craig. That's where it was when Greenspan brought rates down from 5% to 1%. When Greenspan began raising rates in 2004, the Fed funds rate was at 1%. We are just getting there now, and it's taken us 3 years to get there. But do you think that adage holds up? In other words, could we see a bit of a correction after the Fed raises interest rates, or do you think this market powers through that?
It's a great question, and certainly, history is a terrific guide for thinking about financial markets. I don't want to ignore the three steps and a stumble type scenario, but I got to try to put it into the context in my mind that we're coming from an extremely accommodative position for the Fed. We were trying to use monetary policy all around the world to solve any sort of issue that was out there. Just run the printing presses and solve the issue. I would also just note that to me, it seems like, and what I thought was always going to happen was the Fed was always going to be late. The Fed did never want to be early in terms of raising rates because economy was fragile, psychology of investors was very fragile, and if they raised rates too quickly, they ran the risk of seeing a stumble and of then a more protracted period of time that we were in some sort of recession or depression. So even if they're going to go next week, which probabilities seem that they are going to go next week, I'm not too worried about this because I think we're kind of just getting back to normal in terms of where Fed funds rate ultimately should be at. I think it's going to be viewed as more, in my humble opinion, as a sign of confidence than anything else.
And then I guess as you see these rates going up and you see the 10-year going to 3 or 3.25, as we take a look at bull markets, there's another adage that says bull markets don't die of old age. Every one of them gets killed, and the killer or the assassin here is the Federal Reserve. Will they do what they've done so many times since World War II, keep raising rates until they finally break something?
I think with where GDP is at this point in time, I think there's no question that this economic recovery has been slow, has been painful. I would say that this is not something that's going to happen in 2017. I'd be skeptical if it's even 2018. So I think there's still more time, Jim, for this, bull market to continue to work. Inflation doesn't seem to be a problem. I've always said that this bull market will continue to work in equities until you have a 5%, maybe 6% 10-year bond yield. Because when I go back and I look at the history, the correlations, and I go back and I look at the inflection points in 10-year bond yields versus the equity market historically over time, that has been a very important metric and tool to watch. And right now, with where we're at 250 and change on the 10-year bond yield, I think we're a long way away from seeing this bull market from running into any real problem. And even if the Fed raises rates, I thought it would be twice this year. Maybe it's now going to be three times. I don't see this really putting a damper to this bull market at this point in time. And keep in mind, Jim, when we get over 275 in the 10-year bond yield, we're going to start to get that asset allocation shift from fixed income to equities happen. And when you go back and look at history, most bull markets have run into problems when the PE multiples are north of 20 on the S&P 500. We still have at least two handles to move up before that would actually happen.
So given where you see the market right now, what would you be doing? You talk about your three R's, rates, which the first another rate hike could be coming next week, rotation, where money will be changing and what sectors will lead, and reflation. So if you had money to put to work right now, where would you put it?
So as I look at all three of these sectors, then you know that we have a very balanced approach to the market. And in print, we are overweight tech, basic materials, and energy. Energy's been kind of a weaker part of this. And then we're underweight the communication media, we're underweight utilities, and we're underweight consumer staples. So if I've got to put money to work today, I am buying things in tech, I am buying things in basic materials, and I'm selectively picking off names to buy inside the energy patch right now. But I want to be playing offense. I don't want to be playing defense. And what I would say to your investors, get some exposure into this market. Most people that I'm talking to are still very nervous. They don't want to put any money to work, and they keep waking up and seeing this market drifting higher, drifting higher, drifting higher. And they've been saying that for the last 200 points or more on the S&P 500. So you need to participate. And if you're nervous, have some cash, but yet at least increase your exposure or have some exposure to equities, because we've seen in the past when rates finally do go up, you're going to get a sell-off in fixed income. That money needs to go somewhere. It's got one place to go, in my view, and that'll be equities. That would be the advice that I would provide to people and have been providing to people, is recognize that this is a bull market, recognize that there will be some little bumps along the way, but that the primary trend is still up and you want to participate.
All right. Well, listen, Craig, as we close, if our listeners would like to follow your work, how could they do so, please?
They're welcome to email me at craig.w.johnson@pjc.com, or they can check out the Piper Jaffray website.
All right. So summing up, Craig, you still see this market heading higher. 2424 is your year-end target number. Three themes you see going forward: rates, rotation, and reflation. We've been speaking with Craig Johnson from Piper Jaffray. Craig, thanks for joining us on the program.
Thanks for having me.
You're listening to the Financial Sense News Hour at financialsense.com.
You know, Financial Sense News Hour listeners should remember that our premium members are able to hear the weekday Financial Sense News Hour, featuring interviews with top economic commentators and experts. If you're not a member, here's one of the interviews you missed this week.
Last week, when we got that big move up after Trump's speech, I noted that I was selling into that. We're going to reload probably in about a month or so. But at this point in time, I'm looking for some major whipsaw to occur. Yes, we started pulling back, but from an Elliott wave perspective, we're now in what I call a fourth wave in a much larger third. That means we're going to see some consolidation and some whipsaw.
We've had a nice run-up in gold recently, but it's been pulling back, and likewise with oil. But something else is occurring at the same time. The stocks are diverging from the price of the commodity. What does that mean? Is it telling us anything? Joining us on the program from U.S. Global is Frank Holmes. Frank, let's begin with gold. We had gold rising out of December, got up to $1,258. But before it did so, the stocks started to fall a month before. Even though gold was rising, the stocks were going down. There was a divergence. Can you give me an explanation or your take on why we're seeing that?
There were so many financings being contemplated and shopped around the street, and there were so many big deals were done. And I think that this is a sort of a supply factor coming out. And the gold funds themselves have not been getting big fund flows. Even though these gold stocks have had a spectacular move in the past year, I've done this mathematical, I call it database management, and gone around, and it's predominantly quant funds that have been buying these gold stocks. Money flows going into the GDX and GDXJ, but the stellar performers on a few different specific factors I've written about, it's quant funds. So with the sentiment of new financing taking place, a lot of the active gold fund managers would loosen up in some of their positions to buy something they think is more attractive. So in this quarter, as the results have been coming out, a lot of the gold mining companies have not met expectations as people became more bullish and looking for earnings. And what to me is really interesting in our data mining is that we track 88 gold producers globally. And what we noticed that astounded us was that in June of last year, out of those 88 gold producers, and gold was up almost 30%, and you would think the earnings per share would be up 30%. And guess what? They were minus 2%. So I went back and started finding out. And why? Because they keep issuing stock faster than they're growing their revenue. And so you're just seeing this sort of value destruction. And those companies that far outperformed didn't do this, that they're showing this stronger cash flow per share growth. And one of the important factors we look at is the revenue per share and the cash flow per share for the last quarter over the four quarters. And those stocks historically, in a diversified portfolio, outperform the GDX and GDXJ with less risk.
Frank, let me ask you a question, because one of the criticisms of the managers of gold companies, especially in the bull market that all the way running up to 2011, is that they were not shareholder friendly. They went on expensive acquisitions. They over-diluted shareholders. What you're telling me, they just did that again.
Yeah, and a lot of them were rationalized there that they're repairing their balance sheet and they're going to be more prudent, but really, they've not. It doesn't show up. The other thing we have to be cognizant of, that's the bullish sign, is that supply is dropping. That a lot of mines are exhausted. Their grades are falling. It's much more difficult. The only countries that are really showing this great free cash flow is where the country's currency is weak relative to the price of the U.S. dollar. So they get that margin expansion. So you see that the South Africans and the Australian gold stocks were much stronger. And then companies that are in Latin America, so like a classic would be a new stock that's been created. It's called Lia Gold. And we're shareholders in Lia Gold. And there it's in Mexico, so all their costs are in pesos, but they're getting U.S. dollar prices. And they did a unique transaction with Goldcorp, and they bought that production. So they come out of the gate, and based on our models, on a relative basis, it's 50% discount to all the other mid-cap gold stocks. And we like the fact that the peso, we don't think, is going to take off in a tear. It's going to remain vulnerable to Trump's dialogue and narrative, and that's bullish for the gold and silver producers.
You know what amazes me? When you sell a commodity, as let's say these companies do, they sell gold. They're selling at the same price everybody else does. So how you distinguish yourself from your competitors is, number one, you control your costs better. You can produce the commodity cheaper than anybody else, which depends on the technique and the grades of the type of gold fields that you own. But another way is management in becoming shareholder friendly, doing things that enhance the value of the stock. But these guys don't seem to learn. I don't know why it is it plagues this industry in such a way.
I agree. It's like the old days. The airline industry was plagued with this, with destroyers of value. And the boards of directors, they don't meet and discuss relative cash flow returns on invested capital. And that's the single biggest simple factor to look at that Warren Buffett looks at. And you have to be in the top 25%. So let's say the top 20 gold stocks that have the highest cash flow returns on invested capital outperform any GDX or GDXJ. And they just don't get it. And I used to speak at the Denver Gold Show, and I chastised them in 2007 for value destroyers. I had the year before was Robert Friedman. That year in 2007, it was the keynote, and I said, this is what you've done. The CAGR for shares rising has been 15%, but you've not shown that returns on capital, et cetera. They didn't like hearing that, so they complained. So I've not been back to speak to them since then.
Have you found anybody in the industry that gets shareholder value and, you know, return on capital and things like that? Because I tell you, I can't think of an industry that is so poorly run.
I think the royalty companies do that, and that's why I love them. I think they're much more cognizant of cash flow per share and value per share. And every time these guys do a financing, it's always at a rising book value. So it's accretive to them on a price to book. And they're the only stocks in the gold industry that have rising price to book. And that attracts a lot of non-gold investors that like that as a discipline.
Well, it's absolutely amazing. You would think after making mistakes, they would learn their lessons. But from what you told me, they certainly haven't.
It's only a handful.
Okay.
And, you know, I'd say that Frank Giustra, as chairman for this new company called Lia Gold, which will be producing close to 300,000 ounces of gold, they're very disciplined because they wrote checks all along, and it's their money, and they know that this is an important metric to see the stock go up. So I think one has to take a look. Out of the 88 gold producers in the world, there's maybe 10, 12, but in running a mutual fund, I have to turn around and have a minimum of 22 names. And so it makes it much more difficult who are champions of return on capital. The royalty companies are clearly that way, and then some of the other mid-caps. And another one that seems to have had a wake-up call has been Grand Columbia, which were big gold note holders, which trade now on the Toronto Stock Exchange. And you get almost a 10% coupon that's convertible into stock for the next 7 years, pays out monthly. So while you're waiting for this company, which is debt-free now, except for the gold note it has, which is like a royalty that you own, and they're going to buy back their bonds, and that means they're going to shrink the number of shares outstanding. They made a statement they're going to buy back $12 million a year. That means they're going to shrink their market cap by 12% a year. So that discipline has a bunch of capital market savvy people that went on the board this time last year.
Well, so we have a handful of companies that are shareholder friendly. Let's talk about the price of gold. It was rising, and maybe you can explain this to our listeners. Just before the December rate hike by the Fed, you saw gold going down in anticipation of rising interest rates. The Fed raises interest rates in December, and gold bottoms at 1129 and then goes all the way up to 1258. Now we have the Fed meeting next week. It's widely anticipated they're going to raise interest rates another quarter of a point. Is this explaining the weakness that you're seeing in gold right now?
Correct. It's sell on this negative news and anticipate. And I think the other point is for your investors is that I published a piece, and I think it's just a very useful explanation called My Frank Talk was that gold gets a shot in the arm from inflation in China. And that was on the February 21st. And in there, I showed what the treasury yields were for 2, 5, and 10 years, and or 3 and 10 years. And I showed the CPI was at 2.5. Well, what happened from December to January is the CPI numbers jumped from 2.1, basically, up to 2.5. Inflation's rising. So when I took a look at the real interest rates for 2-year government bonds, it's minus 1.2%. 3-year government bonds was minus 0.55. And 10 years was minus 0.05. Well, now the 10-year government bond has been rising for the past 10 days. So now you have positive real rates of return for a 10-year government bond, and that's what's put pressure on gold. It's a beautiful inverse relationship, and I think the 10-year will rally going up to that date, and then it sells off, and gold rallies.
And gold rallies.
We're going to go from a headwind right now to a tailwind. And that tailwind is going to be in the use of the bounce, and we're going to have that debt ceiling battle. And that's just always good for gold.
So the next crisis in Washington, well, let's turn our attention to another commodity where we're seeing the same thing happen, Frank, and that's the price of oil and the divergence with the oil stocks. Now, I dare say that the oil companies are better managed than the gold companies, but, you know, you saw that spike of oil coming out of April into May, but the stocks lagged. We saw it again in October. And we're seeing it again now. So what's your take on the difference in spread between the performance of, let's say, the oil stocks and the price of the commodity itself?
It's a debt problem, and it's a sentiment debt problem. And so what has happened is that there were many more bankruptcies in energy than there were mining, by far, far margin. The mining companies were all able to salvage themselves somehow to raise capital. Glencore got money from Franco-Nevada, was able to raise money at a big premium to book. And they sold basically a stream to Franco-Nevada. Their stock then surged 300%. They were able to rescue themselves. There's over $100 billion of bankruptcies in the energy space. And when oil was under $50 a barrel, the Fed basically was pulling the reins of all the big banks and said, you have to get rid of performing loans because we've had too many bad loans. We deem that as a risk according to our models. So you had the Merrill Lynch's of the world, Bank of America, selling $6 billion of energy loans. There's no money really for these energy companies. And so they have to maintain this drilling for fracking. They have to continuously have to be drilling. And so the cost of capital went from 3% to about 6 to 7% because they had to start borrowing from private equity firms. And so talking to private energy companies, they saw that big, when you do the price discovery for the cost of capital, it had doubled. So that was the negative sentiment in the stocks.
Okay. But as we go forward, we're looking at the price of oil. There's rumors, at least they're only rumors at this time, that OPEC will have to extend those production cuts beyond June. I found it interesting, Frank, that the head of OPEC is going around and talking to hedge funds and traders, trying to get their input in terms of the things that they do and their impact on the oil markets. And that's something interesting. We haven't seen that happen before. So the feeling is in the industry, I don't know if you agree with this, OPEC is sort of a floor on oil, and American shale production is sort of the ceiling. So we've got oil trading in a $10 range.
Correct. And guess what? Oil above $50 a barrel, below 60, above 50, is so good for so many industries. It's great for the state of Texas. I mean, they've been able to get their cost structure down greatly. It's better for real estate in Houston area. And below $50 starts putting lots of stress. They need natural gas over $3 and oil over $50. And the economic engines of America are ripping and roaring. It's good for the airline industry. We still throw off that free cash flow. So I think we're going to see this, and we'll see the benefits showing up in other parts of the economy.
So as you take a look at, we've got a president that wants to stimulate growth, whether it's infrastructure spending, spending on defense, tax cuts, deregulation. That should be good for the economy, which means more oil consumption. The IEA just published its report saying that as a result of emerging market growth, India and elsewhere, that oil consumption globally should still go up at a little over a million barrels a day. That's good for the industry. Given this disparity that we see between the price of the commodity and the stocks, would you be a buyer here?
Absolutely. Buy on those dip and sell down sell days. We're historically at a low in the seasonal cycle for oils in February. So it is going into this sort of trough period. And then we start to get a surge. And it's really remarkable to see the continuously consumption, rising consumption imports into India and China. And people have to remember this, it's 40% of the world. India is 40% of the world's population. And they're all bought into the American dream, and they all want houses. But before they can afford a house, they're all getting cars. And it's just track those car sales. And you can see the best-selling car in China is the Buick. And I think that these are sort of the positive aspects that we have to look at. And one of the things we look at in our macro themes is the what's called PMI, Purchasing Manufacturers Index. And there's a global factor. And what we've noticed in all our regressional work is that when the 1 month is above the 3 months, that it's a precursor for stronger copper and oil prices. That's got a high 70% positive correlation, which to us is if you're a sports person, is a great batting average. And since last summer, global PMIs remain strong and positive. So that is, to me, more bullish why I would say on corrections, you buy the oil stocks.
All right. Well, listen, Frank, given you follow the commodity markets as well as other markets very closely, given what you see in gold and oil, you would say that we're just ahead of a stronger season for both commodities. Would that be fair to say?
Yeah, I would be. I can't see rates going up substantially in real rates because if they do, that'll stifle the economy. It'll stifle car sales. It'll stifle everything. So it's a very fine line unless they get tax breaks and streamline corporate taxes. If they can get some of these things, these policies through, that would be a positive change. And then rates can rise. So we've been strangled. There's a huge sea change taking place with monetary policy dictating, taking away price discovery for the cost of money when Fed funds is zero, and fiscal policy of strangulation by regulation. We're seeing that there's a change taking place in a sentiment, and Trump has lots of things to fight with this, but he's going to continue. But we're seeing this in other countries all of a sudden buying into, we need fiscal stimulus, and that means lower taxes and deregulation. So in fact, if America just kept taxes as they are, but they have the regulations everywhere, then you would see commodities take off. Now, recently I was at the Goldman Sachs conference, and they said that they turned bullish in November on the commodity cycle because after Trump's win, that small businesses, which generate more than 50% of all job creation, had a 5.5 sigma standard deviation move. I mean, that's an earthquake of 10. I mean, it's massive move of confidence and sentiment. And we're witnessing each month as we roll along here, CapEx is up, people are spending more, people are looking for higher paying jobs, they're looking for employees with higher pay skills, etc. So I'm constructively bullish on the fact that this audience that's so key for job growth turn bullish, and let's keep our seatbelts on.
All right. Well, listen, Frank, as we close, if our listeners want to follow the work that you do, how can they do so, please?
Go to usfunds.com, usfunds.com. and subscribe to Frank Talk. It's my blog, and there's also the Investor Alert, which is collectively sent all around the world, and to over 180 countries are reading our thoughts on a weekly basis.
I enjoy reading it every time I can. Frank, thanks so much for joining us on the program. You have yourself a great weekend.
Well, thank you, and same with you.
Now, coming up next on The Big Picture, you know, in the last 2 weeks, we've done a series on seven megatrends impacting the next decade. But lo and behold, we have some more megatrends that we feel deserve an entire show all to themselves. And today we're going to examine the subject of infrastructure. Infrastructure spending is becoming rapidly important for governments in the West, and it has large monetary taxation and investment implications, as much of the infrastructure of parts of the Western world is in desperate need of repair. So we'll discuss that coming up next on the Financial Sense News Hour. Also, the Fed is expected to meet for the second time this year, coming up next week. And it's also widely expected they will raise interest rates, making it the third rate hike, taking the Fed funds rate to 1%. But what are they doing here? I mean, can they justify this? It wouldn't seem to be, from the growth, the low growth in the economy. So are they following their age-old pattern of raising rates and waiting until something breaks and saying, oops, that's it, we went too far? Well, it would seem that's what they're going to do. We'll discuss all of that coming up next on The Big Picture as the Financial Sense News Hour continues at financialsense.com.